Thank you very much, and hello, everyone. This is Andrew Sokup. I'm co-chair of Covington's Class Action Litigation Practice Group, and I help defend financial institutions from a variety of class action and commercial litigation. I'm joined today by my colleagues Ashley Simonson and Henry Liu, who, like me, help defend financial institutions from litigation.
Hi, everyone. This is Ashley Simonson, and it's nice to speak with you all today. I also am a partner in Covington's Class Action Litigation Practice Group, and I'm located in our Los Angeles office. Like Andrew, I focus my practice on defending financial institutions from class action litigation. Before becoming a lawyer, I worked at Lehman Brothers, where I worked with banks on balance sheet management and hedging strategies. Henry?
Thanks, Ashley. My name is Henry Liu. I'm a litigation partner based in the DC office, and like Andrew and Ashley, my practice involves class actions with a particular focus on antitrust, RICO, and state consumer protection claims.
Well, we want to thank everyone for joining us for our financial services teleconference series, Taking Stock, the Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. This is the eighth session in our weekly series, with additional presentations on white-collar and housing finance updates on offer in the coming weeks. We're excited to be able to offer this series to our friends and clients. Before we begin, we have a few housekeeping items to mention. First, for those interested in CLE credit, today's program is approved for a half hour of credit in New York and California. Affirmation forms were linked in the reminder notice that you received for today's call. Folks will need to record the affirmation code we will share toward the end of the call and return the form to our colleague, Elizabeth Christiani. Her information is on the form, and she will give you a certificate of attendance. Second, we would be happy to answer any questions that you may have during the program. Please forward any questions you may have to Al McManus at AMCMANUS, that's AMCMANUS, at COV.com. We will attempt to answer as many questions as possible, but we would also be pleased to connect with you on an individual basis following the presentation. And now, on to our discussion. Today, we intend to discuss litigation developments in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. I will begin by discussing litigation arising out of the Paycheck Protection Program, which we will refer to as the PPP throughout this call. Next, Ashley will continue that discussion by addressing lawsuits by agents who are seeking to be paid out of fees lenders receive under the PPP, and also discuss other litigation and enforcement trends during COVID-19. Finally, as courts remain closed across the country and more depositions occur remotely, Henry will provide an update on how litigation is quickly changing in response to the pandemic and best practices going forward. We will begin today by discussing the explosion of litigation in the past month related to the PPP. Broadly speaking, the lawsuits we plan to discuss today fall into three categories: lawsuits by small businesses against financial institutions, lawsuits filed against the government challenging SBA's rules, and lawsuits by agents who claim lenders are required to pay agent fees. We will discuss each of these in turn. We emphasize that the law in this space is evolving rapidly, and many of the decisions reached so far that we will discuss have come in the context of temporary restraining orders or preliminary injunctions. If there is a common theme in these cases, it is one of confusion, where plaintiffs' lawyers are seeking to exploit what they view as unclear or ambiguous guidance from the SBA. We'll begin by talking about the lawsuits that small businesses have filed against financial institutions. Broadly speaking, these lawsuits take issue with the way that lenders process loans. Some cases accuse banks of violating the CARES Act based on the way they prioritize loans, either by prioritizing loans from existing customers over newer customers, or by prioritizing high-dollar loans over low-dollar loans. Other cases take issue with bank operating systems, on the theory that banks made it too difficult to apply for loans. The first wave of cases that was filed argued that the CARES Act created a private right of action, and also argued that lenders' lending decisions were limited to the two criteria set forth in the CARES Act, namely, whether the borrower was in business on February 15, and whether the borrower paid salary and taxes for employees were only paid independent contractors. The first decision, Profiles versus Bank of America out of the District of Maryland, rejected this argument. It found instead that the CARES Act did not limit banks to these two criteria, but could instead allow banks to prioritize applications however they chose and to consider other information in making lending decisions. And for support, the court noted that a draft bill had included such a requirement, but was eventually dropped from the final version. Profiles is also significant because it observed that there is no private federal right of action to enforce the PPP criteria. Now, that case is now on appeal before the Fourth Circuit, and the Profiles case got a fair amount of attention in the legal press. And in response, the plaintiffs largely changed their legal strategy. The second wave of cases that we began to see argued that borrowers were deceived into thinking that their applications would be processed on a first-come, first-served basis. And had borrowers known that a different order would have been followed, they claimed that they would have gone elsewhere to try to obtain funding through the PPP. The claims that have been asserted rely on a variety of state law causes of action, including for fraud, misrepresentation, unjust enrichment, and violations of state causes of action. From our perspective, these suits suffer from several challenges, and the most significant challenge is that a successful plaintiff would have to demonstrate that they could have been approved for a loan had they gone elsewhere. We view that as a significant obstacle to the plaintiff's ability not only to prevail on the merits, but also to obtain class certification. The other area of lawsuits that we are tracking is lawsuits that have been filed against the Treasury and against the Small Business Administration. There's been many lawsuits that have been filed, but we want to focus our discussion today on two of the cases. The first type of cases involve businesses that the SBA deemed ineligible for the PPP loans. After the CARES Act was enacted, the SBA adopted a rule excluding a variety of businesses, such as banks, lobbying firms, certain private clubs with restrictive admission practices, and adult entertainment businesses from receiving PPP loans. Now, this is not a new rule. The SBA essentially promulgated the ineligibility rule that applies to normal Section 7A SBA loans and said that rule applied in the PPP context. But a series of lawsuits were filed challenging the SBA's ineligibility criteria as applied to PPP loans based on differences from the way the CARES Act provisions on PPP funding differ from the way the provisions apply to normal SBA Section 7A loans. And this month, two judges in Wisconsin and in Michigan have sided with these businesses. Last week's decision in Michigan in the DV Diamond Club of Flint versus SBA case is particularly instructive and should be noted by all banks that have PPP lending programs. The court in that case noted that the CARES Act, by saying PPP funds are available to, quote, any business concern, end quote, that satisfies the CARES Act criteria, unambiguously provides that every business meeting the statutory criteria is eligible for a PPP loan during the covered period. In other words, nothing in the CARES Act authorized the exclusion of adult businesses, and the court therefore issued a preliminary injunction prohibiting the SBA from enforcing its ineligibility criteria, and the Sixth Circuit has refused to lift that injunction. There is significant tension between the Profiles case we discussed earlier and this new DV Diamond Club case, even though they were filed in very different contexts. And this distinction may have implications for bank defendants in prioritization cases discussed earlier. Profiles holds that lenders are not limited to the criteria in the CARES Act, but DV Diamond Club takes a different approach and says that the criteria in the CARES Act are the only criteria that apply. It remains to be seen which of these two competing interpretations, even though they were decided in different contexts, will end up carrying the day. The second lawsuit we are tracking is a case out of the Central District of California filed by two businesses that are seeking to invalidate FAQs 31 and 37 of the SBA's recent guidance, which relate to the certification that businesses must obtain in order to obtain PPP funding. Now, borrowers may generally only access SBA loans if they certify that the current economic uncertainty makes this loan request necessary to support the business's ongoing operation. And in response to news reports that large businesses or other businesses that otherwise had access to capital may instead have taken PPP loans, SBA published two FAQs that said when businesses make this certification, they must take into account their ability to access other sources of liquidity sufficient to support their ongoing operations. Now, before this guidance was issued, three businesses took out PPP loans because their loan terms were more favorable than their other loan options available. And they filed suit in the Central District of California, arguing that this guidance is invalid in light of another provision in the CARES Act, which says that PPP funding is available regardless of a creditor's ability to obtain credit elsewhere. Case is in its early stages and no litigation has occurred. Financial institutions should be careful to monitor these and future cases that may be filed against government agencies, because the holdings in these cases may significantly impact how banks administer the PPP program going forward and the civil lawsuits that are already filed and may be filed against banks. I'll now turn things over to Ashley, who will discuss the third category of PPP litigation we are monitoring.
Thanks, Andrew. Over the past few weeks, there have been more than a dozen lawsuits filed against many PPP lenders by borrower-side agents claiming that they are entitled to a percentage of the fee that lenders receive from the SBA for processing PPP loan applications. In the spirit of full disclosure here, Covington represents some of these bank defendants, so we are somewhat limited in what we can say about cases that are in active litigation. But in short, in these lawsuits, the agents point out that the SBA's interim final rule prohibited them from seeking compensation from small businesses for helping those businesses apply for PPP loans. Instead, the interim final rule said that agents could receive compensation only from the lender fees paid to the SBA. The lender fees paid by the SBA, subject to a cap of 1% for loans of $350,000 or less. The interim final rule is located at the front of the packet of materials that we distributed in advance of the webinar. The agent's argument in these cases is that they are guaranteed compensation from the lenders at the maximum level allowed by the cap set forth in the interim final rule. This interpretation would be very different from the way normal Section 7A SBA loans work, where an agent is required to complete a Form 159, demonstrate that the fee they are requesting is reasonable in light of the services provided, and obtain the borrower's signature. It is our understanding that the banks in these cases and other banks not named in the litigation have taken very different approaches to this issue. Some have declared that they will refuse to pay agent fees entirely to agents that they did not previously have agreements with. Others are deciding to pay fees to any agent that requests the fee, even if the request is made after loan funding. And still others fall somewhere in between. Neither Treasury nor the SBA has offered guidance on this issue, but it is our understanding that the SBA is aware of the issue, disagrees with the plaintiff's theory, and intends to publish guidance about this issue in the near future. Let's move now to a discussion of other litigation and government and enforcement trends during COVID-19. The first thing to note is that plaintiff's lawyers are still filing run-of-the-mill class actions against financial services companies. Banks and other financial services companies are still facing lawsuits based on unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices, the antitrust laws, and state consumer protection laws. As just one example, in late April, a group of large banks was sued for allegedly conspiring to suppress corporate bond trades of less than $1 million in par value. The antitrust lawsuit alleges that the banks worked together to restrain trading of odd lots of corporate bonds, which are smaller trades made mainly by individuals. Turning to government and enforcement trends, much like the 2008 financial crisis relief programs, pandemic-related relief programs likely will spur robust government oversight and enforcement activity. On the heels of the TARP stimulus came more than a decade of criminal and regulatory enforcement actions, resulting in hundreds of criminal convictions and billions of dollars of financial penalties. The CARES Act dwarfs the TARP stimulus in terms of size and scope, which likely will mean even more outsized enforcement enforcement activity this time around. Our partner, Arlo Devlin Brown, will provide a more robust update on white collar and enforcement trends during COVID-19 on next week's webinar session in our series. But as a brief update on government and enforcement trends we are seeing, the CARES Act created bodies, including the Special Inspector General for Pandemic Recovery, the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, and the COVID-19 Congressional Oversight Commission, are entering the fray, as are traditional authorities like DOJ and Inspectors General. DOJ already has directed all U.S. attorneys to prioritize the detection, investigation, and prosecution of illegal conduct related to COVID-19, including through the appointment of a coronavirus fraud coordinator. The chief of the DOJ's criminal division, which includes the fraud section, has said his division is working with other law enforcement agencies to go after fraud, targeting the funds Congress allocated for pandemic relief in the CARES Act. We also understand that DOJ has made informal outreaches to banks seeking their assistance in ferreting out potential borrower fraud in connection with PPP loans. Andrew mentioned earlier the FAQs that were published by the SBA, requiring borrowers on PPP loans to certify that those loans were necessary in order to get and keep loan funds. There is a safe harbor for borrowers on loans of $2 million or less. But Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has promised that any borrower who received over $2 million and seeks loan forgiveness will be audited, threatening criminal liability for any business that falsely certified that its loan was necessary. Our colleagues Amanda Kramer and Daniel Suleiman discussed this issue and whether companies should return their PPP loans to avoid potential liability in the article located on page 27 of the packet of materials we distributed in advance of the webinar. As they explain in the article, investigators could probe the basis for the certification made by borrowers back in April for years to come, as the statute of limitations for criminal fraud may be as long as 10 years. On April 28th, Mnuchin emphasized that it's the borrowers who have criminal liability if they made this certification and it's not true. But FDIC Chairwoman Yelena McWilliams told members of the Senate Banking Committee on May 12th that for larger banks, our instructions have been to rely on the certification, but be cognizant of who they're lending to. They have to cross their T's and dot their I's, she said. She also emphasized that all banks must comply with existing fair lending laws when making PPP loans. I'll turn it over now to Henry to focus on some of the issues we're seeing relating out of logistics of litigation arising out of COVID-19.
Thanks, Ashley. So in addition to the new COVID-19 related litigation we're seeing, we were also asked by participants to spend a few minutes touching on two issues. The first is an update on the current status of the courts, particularly jurisdictions where many cases against financial institutions are pending. And the second is an overview of logistical issues and practical considerations that we've encountered with cases that have started to proceed remotely. So with respect to the status of the courts, the vast majority of courts are operational and judges are working, but are closed for trials and live hearings. In the Southern District of New York and the Eastern District of New York, where a lot of our financial services clients find themselves, there are standing orders suspending jury trials indefinitely in the Southern District or through mid-June in the Eastern District. It's safe to assume there will be no trials until at least July or August at the earliest, potentially much later. The courts themselves are open for business, i.e. for filing of case documents, motions, practice, and teleconference hearings, but in-person hearings are adjourned except for urgent criminal matters and TROs. We just learned that there is a phased reopening plan, at least in the Southern District of New York, that includes social distancing in courtrooms and guards checking temperatures at the entrance. In the meantime, judges are conducting hearings by telephone or Zoom, and we expect that to continue in the near term. So far, I haven't experienced any incident like the one in the Supreme Court where one of the justices flushed a toilet during oral arguments, but I'm sure similar mishaps are bound to happen. New York State trial courts are in a similar situation with respect to trials and hearings. The court has also taken the extra step of barring the commencement, the filing of any new non-essential case, with that restriction easing later this week in certain upstate counties. And finally, on the other side of the country, in the Northern District of California, the chief judge Monday issued an order stating that no assurances can be given as to when civil trials can be resumed, and ordered that all civil cases pending engage in settlement discussions. The court itself remains closed for in-person hearings through at least June 1. Now, that wasn't intended to be a comprehensive overview, but rather just to give everyone a sense of where the trend line is today. Most cases are proceeding, but trials are at a standstill. The one exception is that there is an insurance coverage trial in Texas state court that is proceeding via Zoom. They actually just did jury selection by Zoom. And we'll see how that goes, but it could be a test case for how trials end up being conducted going forward if the pandemic lasts well into the future. Now, turning to the question of, you know, logistical and practical considerations that we've encountered with remote depositions and litigation. In our pending civil cases, there was an across-the-board stand-down in activity, particularly depositions in March, April, and May, while the world was being turned upside down. And with the reality now setting in that travel is not going to return to normal for months, if not until next year, many of our cases have been transitioning to remote hearings and depositions. And there are a number of obvious challenges with remote litigation, and particularly depositions. Among other things, you need to ensure that the participants and the witness home technology situation is adequate. Everyone has monitors, iPads, audio equipment, need to have internet bandwidth, particularly where multiple family members are required to use the internet at the same time for Zoom classes or work meetings. There's the security of the platform. You need to consider the fairness of remote depositions where witnesses can't really review documents in their entirety or have an opportunity to confer with counsel privately. And perhaps most importantly, they're just the practical realities where witnesses might be responsible for children or family members and just not have a safe, private, a distraction-free location for the deposition. In some cases, we've been successful in getting an indefinite postponement of depositions where, for example, the witness just doesn't have the capability or availability to do a deposition from their home, or a 30B6 deposition that requires a review of files that are physically in the office. But as the pandemic lingers on, courts in our cases have been increasingly pushing parties towards moving cases along the best they can by remote means. And we thought it'd be useful to give a very brief overview of the key issues we've dealt with in preparing for remote depositions and some general guidance. On the key issues, there are a host of logistical problems that have come up in our active cases, but there are a few that are repeatedly top of mind. The first is witness and attorney technology and availability. And we found that at a minimum, all participants in a deposition, especially the witness, will need a computer, preferably with multiple screens, secure, reliable internet access, a computer microphone and or telephone, high quality webcam, and the ability to spend an entire day in front of a screen. These minimum requirements have been the number one hurdle to overcome, and we found the following to be helpful. One is to make sure that participants consider data usage on the day of depositions. Now, it's not reasonable to expect children to stop Zoom classes, but Netflix, video games, and other high data usage can really affect the quality of depositions. Second, consider sending extra equipment such as iPads or additional monitors to a witness in advance. Some vendors have that ability to loan to witnesses on demand additional equipment for minimal costs. And finally, we found it very helpful to set aside time to test equipment and to do a dry run with the witness. Aside from technology, the second big and related issue is the choice of vendors. In general, we think the key differentiators between the vendors are security, availability of features, live technical support, and the ability to provide needed technology equipment on demand. Our colleagues have tested over a dozen of these vendors and are happy to provide our views offline to anyone who's interested. The high-level summary is that vendors' remote deposition programs are not all created equal, and some are considerably more user-friendly than others, and others have substantially better technical support. The final key issue we've been dealing with is the unique challenges with preparing witnesses for depositions. Deposition preparation can be significantly more challenging remotely. It's just hard to have a witness pay attention over Skype or Zoom for a whole day. I'm sure everyone is sensitive to that. Defense counsel in particular, you know, we're used to being in the same room to prepare and defend witnesses, even if opposing counsel appears by video conference. On this issue, we have found that it's important to anticipate and account for that when scheduling prep sessions. Prep that would ordinarily take 2 days really might need to be split into 4 or 5 different sessions, especially if there are translation or time zone differences. There's a lot more to be said on this topic. We hope that gives everyone a little bit of the flavor of the issues that we've been seeing and dealing with. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Andrew.
Thanks, Henry. One question is, with many bank employees working from home, how much success are bank defendants having at persuading courts or opposing parties to stay cases or delay discovery?
The short answer is some. We're in an interim period where there are discovery stays in most civil cases, particularly as to depositions, not all, but most. We do expect that cases as we go further into the summer, we'll begin resuming, and that courts will be increasingly looking to the parties to conduct depositions remotely and move those cases along.
Well, thanks, Henry. That brings us to the end of today's session. For those who are interested in CLE credit, this is the code to be recorded on the remote attendee affirmation form. And capitalization matters. The code is capital T5Y3. Again, that's capital T5Y3. One more time, it is capital T5, lowercase y, and 3. As mentioned at the start of the program, this is the 8th of our teleconference series. We hope you found this to be of value and will join us over the next few weeks, including our colleague Arlo Devlin-Brown next week. His session will address the impact COVID-19 has had and likely will continue to have on DOJ, SEC, CFTC, and other investigations and enforcement matters impacting financial institutions. The webinar will also cover subjects of potential future investigations relating to fallout from COVID-19. You can find additional information about our financial services teleconference series on the events page of our website, www.cov.com, and on our COVID-19 toolkit page. Links to both are included in the meeting materials. Again, many thanks for joining us today. If you have any questions following the call, please feel free to reach out to Henry, Ashley, or myself with any questions you may have. Take care.